I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, the weekly podcast illuminating issues in agriculture and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are answered using a science-based approach with the goal of driving innovation to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Paul Vincelli.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that can help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Folta, and today we're going to be talking about a disease that is one of the most important plant diseases to epidemics to have occurred in North America, and that is the blight of chestnut, the American chestnut. And our speaker today is Dr. Jared Westbrook from the American Chestnut Foundation, and one of the premier people to really discuss this topic and give us some insight into where we've been and where we're going. So Jared, welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast, and thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
American chestnut and the chestnut blight is something that we plant pathologists have studied and always make sure our students learn something about. But we may have listeners who know very little about the subject. And so maybe you could start, Jared, by giving us an overview of the American chestnut, and then we'll, of course, move into the chestnut blight itself, the biology and importance. But give us a sense of the importance of the American chestnut in the history of the United States.
Well, the American chestnut was a dominant canopy tree species in the eastern United States. It has a range that stretched from Alabama, Mississippi, all the way up into Maine and Ontario. And in the Appalachian Mountains in particular, it was particularly economically important species. The people of the Appalachians used the seeds for a source of food. They fed their livestock on the chestnut seeds. The wood was lightweight and rot resistant, and many structures, barns and railroad ties, fence posts all around the eastern United States in the mountains were made of American chestnut. And in the 1900s, 1904 is actually when the chestnut blight was discovered in the Bronx Zoo on presumably nursery stock from Asia. So Japanese chestnuts, we were importing chestnuts from Asia for nut production. And this disease, it colonizes the bark of chestnut. It's a fungus. It gets into the wounds. It secretes something that makes the bark very acidic, oxalic acid, and that creates a canker on the stem, and it girdles the stem, and the tree dies. Mm-hmm. So luckily, it's able to resprout from once it gets killed, the top gets killed. But basically, this disease was introduced in 1904, and it spread across the entire range of the American chestnut by 1950 and killed nearly 4 billion trees. Today it's functionally extinct.
Yeah, it's functionally extinct. Yeah, that's a good phrase. And I've seen, the stump sprouts of American chestnut, but you're right, I have never seen a fully grown American chestnut. One of the statistics that impressed me in a negative way, I should say, but still the importance of this issue really came home when I realized that one out of four, if I've got this statistic right, one out of four trees in the Appalachian region was American chestnut. So everywhere you look, American chestnut was dominant, would be roughly one out of four. Is that a correct statistic, or have I missed?
I mean, yes, that especially in, it's a locally abundant tree. So like in the ridge tops of the Appalachian Mountains, you can find many stump sprouts today. So yes, it was locally abundant. I wouldn't think that the over the entire eastern United States, it was one in four trees, but certainly when the areas where it's most well-suited, its habitat is, it's, it grows best is like these well-drained soils in, this, in the mountains. Mm-hmm. And there it was locally abundant, one in four.
Okay. So tell us about chestnut blight.
Basically, it's a necrotrophic pathogen. It kills... it goes in and it colonizes the stem of the tree, and it kills the growing tissue, the cambium of the stem, and it basically feeds off of that tissue as it's it kills the that tissue and feeds off of it, and then it is transmitted via spores and insects and birds to other trees. So it's ubiquitous and naturalized within North America, and it comes from Asia.
So basically, our trees, American chestnut trees, didn't co-evolve with this fungus, and so when it was introduced, it really wreaked havoc.
Exactly, and the Asian species of chestnut, Chinese chestnut, Japanese chestnut, they have co-evolved with chestnut blight, so they are resistant to the disease. They still get chestnut blight, but they the cankers tend to be confined to smaller areas on the stem, so the tree has some resistance and it doesn't affect the growth. It doesn't really kill the main stem of the trees.
Yeah, so it was pretty much just one of the most destructive epidemics we've seen in North America on any plant, and it remains important today. So you are the I don't think I gave your title. You're the director of science at the American Chestnut Foundation, and in fact, I've heard you speak on the topic of chestnut blight. And so tell us, many listeners may have not heard of the American Chestnut Foundation. So tell us about that organization.
Well, the American Chestnut Foundation's mission is simple. It's to restore the American chestnut back to the eastern forest. It's simple in what we're doing, like what our goal is, but it's anything but simple in terms of the implementation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Not only are we dealing with chestnut blight as something that affects, hinders the restoration of American chestnut, but we also have a second pathogen, Phytophthora cinnamomi, which colonizes the roots of American chestnut. American chestnut is very susceptible to this pathogen, which was also introduced from Asia. It in contrast to chestnut blight, this root pathogen kills the trees outright. So it's thought that the introduction of Phytophthora from crops from Southeast Asia wiped out American chestnut from the lower elevation forests of the southeastern United States prior to the introduction of chestnut blight. So we have two pathogens that we're trying to introduce resistance to into these populations. And we're also trying to capture the native diversity that's remaining in the forest so the trees will be able to adapt to any sort of future climates that are occurring. So the population now is about 450 million root sprouts that are remaining in the forest out of 4 billion trees, and we need to capture much of that diversity so the species can continue to evolve on its own.
Mm. So when you say capture, you mean get live plant material from additional trees and bring it into your plantation? Is that
Yeah, get this live material from wild trees. We've been opportunistically finding flowering American chestnuts in clear cuts in the sides of like where power line right-of-ways, areas where homes have been introduced, roads. Sometimes as this light stimulates these trees to flower, and they'll flower for like a year, and then they'll die back from the blight. So we can do some breeding with that material for a short period of time. And so we've been using that as the starting point for breeding in blight resistance and phytophthora resistance into our populations.
Okay, so how do you include those trees in the breeding program? You collect pollen from them? And
you know, there's really been two approaches that have gone on in parallel to restore the American chestnut. The first started in the 1980s. It's called back crossbreeding. And basically, take Asian chestnut species and you hybridize them with American chestnut, and you get a, you know, 50-50 Chinese American hybrid, and then back cross that hybrid to American chestnut over three different generations to essentially dilute out genes from Chinese chestnut, except for those involved in blight resistance. So each generation we plant out hundreds of thousands of trees from these crosses, and we inoculate them with the chestnut blight fungus, and we select those individuals with the least severe cankers for advancing to future breeding. So that's been going on, and now we're getting to the point where we are finishing the selection of the most disease-resistant trees in the back cross breeding program.
In the third generation.
So we've done, you know, three generations of back crossing, and then we also take those most resistant hybrids and we cross them together. To enhance resistance further. Okay. And so we end up screening tens of thousands of trees to get to a few hundred selections.
So how long does a generation take?
The generations for American chestnut take about 5 to 10 years for the trees to flower.
Yeah, so it's pretty, you know, you really have to be ready for a long-term commitment when you're working with trees, certainly. And so to review, you've reached the third back cross generation, and now you're intercrossing some of the best looking plant material to further enhance the resistance. Is that right?
And we have done that, and now we're even selecting among the intercross, the progeny of the intercrosses.
Okay.
So that's the final selection, is we have these seed orchards where we're, you know, we've planted, you know, 60,000 trees, and we're getting down to 500 trees. And one of the things that I've been working on is using genomics to figure out where the genes for resistance are in these populations, and then to be able to predict the resistance of the remaining trees with DNA sequencing, so we can speed up the selection process. Mm-hmm. And so that should happen in the next 5 to 10 years when we've actually finished selection in the back cross program.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm imagining is marker assisted selection. The other sort of the phrase that describes that, is that right?
Yeah, it's genomic selection. So we're not just using a few markers. We're using the whole genome, composed of hundreds of thousands of markers to predict disease resistance.
Okay, gotcha. And so for the listeners, we're going to talk here in a few minutes about biotechnological. Well, that is a biotechnological approach, but genetic engineering approaches that have been done with American chestnut as well. And so what your program does is actually not genetic engineering, direct manipulation of the DNA for purposes of enhancing resistance, but you use the DNA information, the sequence information, to enhance the conventional breeding process. Is that a good description?
Yeah, that's a good description, but and that is indeed what we are doing. There's a second in approach with biotechnology.
Sure.
Since the 1990s, researchers at the State University of New York, Bill Powell and Chuck Maynard, they've been seeking a transgenic approach to introduce blight resistance into American chestnut. And they spent about 15 years just working on the, one of the things to actually do the genetic transformation of chestnut, insert genes into chestnut, is you have to be able to clone the trees from cell culture. So they had to create these cell cultures in order to introduce genes into American chestnut. So they spent 15 years just on that technical hurdle.
Okay.
And then the second technical hurdle was figuring out what gene or genes to insert into American chestnut to enhance its blight resistance. And they found that this gene from wheat, oxalate oxidase, which basically the fungus secretes a lot of this oxalic acid, which creates the blight fungus secretes oxalic acid, which creates these cankers. And what the oxalate oxidase gene does is it neutralizes that the secretion of that oxalate, so that basically the fungus can still live. It's not killing the blight fungus, but it's making it less pathogenic on American chestnut. So, you know, the tree will, this fungus can still reproduce in the wild. So conceivably, you know, it's not being select, you know, it's not going to overcome the resistance. So the selection, you know, it's not being selected against by this oxalate oxidase gene.
Yeah. I thought that was, so yeah, it's actually a really interesting story. And for listeners, one of the very first Talking Biotech podcasts was an interview with Dr. Powell, as mentioned by Jarrett. So that's episode number 10, if you're interested in hearing more about that. But that's my understanding. You've affirmed what I somehow learned, maybe through a communication with Dr., you know, with Bill Powell. But this is a really important point, it seems to me, as a plant pathologist. It is that the gene from wheat that degrades this toxic enzyme or degrading enzyme, doesn't poison the fungus, and so therefore should be no selection pressure for the fungus to overcome that gene for resistance. I mean, it seems a reasonable way to, you know, reasonable hypothesis to go forward with.
And, you know, the other thing is that the chestnut blight fungus lives on oak trees. It lives on fallen wood.
Okay.
So it reproduces independently of American chestnut.
Okay.
So the selection pressure should be minimal. But, you know, just to hedge our bets here,
yeah,
that we are planning, the American Chestnut Foundation is planning on pending regulatory approval of the release of this transgenic American chestnut, is planning on breeding some of the, you know, the transgenic tree with our back cross selections.
Mm-hmm.
We're stacking that resistance from the wheat gene and from Chinese chestnut together, so that there's this multifaceted resistance where it's very unlikely that the fungus will overcome that resistance.
Sure. Very defensible, very exciting approach. So I want to pursue that, but let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Dr. Jarrett Westbrook from the American Chestnut Foundation. And we'll learn about what's going on with chestnut improvement to hopefully restore the American chestnut into our forests, and what might the future be in this area. So listeners, thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. We are currently being downloaded 20,000 times per month. That's quite a milestone in podcast excellence. We thank you for your loyalty and your continued support. Now, we don't have those big podcast production budgets. Well, Fult does all the production, websites, and funny voices himself. Our continued success and broader impact relies on you, the listener. Write a review on iTunes. Throw us some stars. And pump a little gas in the electronic content jalopy on the information superhighway as we race towards mile marker 200. Again, thanks for listening. And now back to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast with Dr. Jarrett Westbrook of the American Chestnut Foundation. And he's the director of science there and leading their efforts to improve the resistance of American chestnut to the chestnut blight fungus and the very destructive disease it causes. So, Jarrett, once again, thanks for joining us. And there's a lot that can be said about both approaches to restoration of American chestnut, the program through that you're leading and the program that Bill Powell at SUNY New York is leading. And one of the things that I'm just interested in is to hear your experience with the diversity of opinions that might exist on the use of genetic engineering, this gene from wheat, the oxidase gene from wheat, introduced into American chestnut. There must be diverse opinions about whether that belongs in a restoration program. What's your experience, and how do you engage people with those diverse opinions?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the concerns is about the biodiversity or the genetic diversity of and inbreeding that would result from using this transgenic tree. So Bill Powell has introduced oxalate oxidase into one single American chestnut tree that's been cloned. So we're not going to restore the species by planting many clones with this wheat gene. What we need to do to restore the species so it can adapt to the many environments in which it grows is to cross that transgenic tree with wild American chestnuts. So we capture much of that diversity. But the issue, one of the issues is when you do that first cross, the trees are always going to inherit 50% of their genome from this original clone. So in essence, we have to do multiple outcrosses to American chestnut over two or three generations to dilute out again those genes from that original clone, so that when we do the crossing of these trees, intercrossing in the forest, when they're actually reproducing in the forest, that they will not be inbred. And they won't. These trees, especially American chestnut or any outcrossing tree, carries a large load of deleterious, recessive kind of mutations in its genome, which when you do this inbreeding, when you have inbreeding in the population, it could make the population more susceptible to all kinds of stresses. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is recover that diversity and avoid the inbreeding. I think that's one of the main challenges ahead, and one that the American Chestnut Foundation, Bill is releasing this, potentially releasing this transgenic clone, but then we have this large amount of work to do to capture the diversity of the species and avoid the inbreeding.
Yeah. So one of the things that you commented on in our preliminary discussions was how, with really most genetically engineered crops, there's interest in preventing or minimizing the spread of pollen into other plants, other crops surrounding the field, or maybe other species. Whereas in the case of American chestnut restoration, you are very very much interested in this engineered trait moving into the germplasm that exists out in the wild. So I thought that was an interesting an interesting take and understandable, because without genetic diversity, there is less adaptability of the American chestnut that hopefully we'll be restoring. And also, as you've noted, there's the recessive deleterious genes that might express themselves if there's insufficient genetic diversity in the American chestnut population. So you're actually wanting to encourage the outcrossing of the transgene into as many biotypes as possible.
Absolutely. And then the other thing, that there's an advantage with crossing the transgenic tree with some backcross material, because we have in the backcross program resistance to the second pathogen, Phytophthora cinnamomi. And so we can rapidly, rather than with just a pure breeding approach where there's multiple genes for blight resistance and there's multiple genes for Phytophthora resistance, we have to, every time we increase the number of genes that we're screening for, we have to plant out many, many individuals. The problem of screening becomes very large and daunting. Where now we've essentially simplified the problem with using a single gene for blight resistance. So 50% of the kids from across will inherit that blight resistance gene from wheat, we can easily screen for that gene. It's very straightforward. We don't have to inoculate the trees. We can just look for the enzyme activity. Then we only plant out those guys in the field, and we can screen for phytophthora resistance. So now we're only really screening for one pathogen rather than two. Yeah. So it's a lot simpler.
And a lot easier to make progress. We do progress.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that, but it's true. You know, if you have a quantitatively inherited, or for listeners, that what I mean is multiple genes from Chinese chestnut that all can together contribute to a resistant plant, breeding that is quite hard. And if you just go in with a single gene that's been, you know, the transgene from wheat, then it's simple, nothing simple in biology, but relatively speaking, simplifies the task, so you then can focus on breeding against Phytophthora. And Phytophthora, I've seen the damage that it causes in American chestnut. There was an outplanting that was an experimental outplanting a number of years ago. I remember being in the diagnostic lab when they brought in those plants that were just killed from Phytophthora. So yeah, you've got two very aggressive pathogens to work against. And if the transgene helps simplify it, that seems sensible.
Yes.
So Jared, it seems to me that you know, everybody who I've encountered on this who works in the field, and that is you and Bill Powell and others, view these technologies, the hybridization from Asian species or the transgene from wheat, these different approaches are not competing, but are actually complementary. Is that how you see these?
Absolutely. We've just actually started doing some of these initial crosses between that cross material and transgenic trees. And the goal is to see, is there a, you know, when you combine resistance from Chinese chestnut and the transgene from wheat, you actually have an additive effect on resistance. So you have greater progeny with greater resistance than through either approach alone. And the strength of the backcross program is many years of finding and identifying these flowering American chestnuts, which are rare, and incorporating them into the breeding program and conserving the germplasm, even just of American chestnuts that are susceptible to blight, putting them into orchards that we can use for breeding. And Bill has, you know, potentially higher blight resistance than we have in, or we will achieve in the backcross program with a simplified inheritance. So, you know, we have these two programs, and it just seems like it makes a lot of sense to combine both approaches. And we will do that. But we will also, you know, there's some folks that do not want to plant transgenic American chestnuts, and we'll still continue with, you know, this backcross program where we do have non-transgenic material available to people that want to plant non-transgenic material. And then there's people, especially around Bill Powell in New York, that are they want essentially pure American chestnuts, except for that gene from wheat. So they just want to outcross the transgenic tree to pure American chestnuts. So we're offering people a range of choices for when they want to plant this material.
That's true. So there's no requirement that you use the transgene on in your property, for example. You want to give choice. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, I should have asked this, but after three generations, does it look like an American chestnut for all intents and purposes, three backcross generations?
Yeah, it's all of the leaf and stem characteristics are, you know, exactly like American chestnut. Mm-hmm. So that means, yes, we have recovered the American chestnut form, although there is still variation within the population. There's some trees that are a little more Chinese and less Chinese, but still, it's like, for all intents and purposes, you can't tell the difference between our backcross trees and an American pure American chestnut, except that it has enhanced blight resistance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, as I prepared for this interview, one of the things that occurred to me was really the importance of nonprofit foundations in addressing things like this, because you know, the American Chestnut Foundation has this long-term goal and long-term commitment well beyond any 3 or 5 year federal grant would allow, And, you know, and the same, I think, is often true for the private sector. The private sector funds important projects worldwide in all kinds of ways. But, you know, it's hard to imagine the private sector following, you know, funding this program for many years, many decades is required. But the American Chestnut Foundation does. And this reminds me of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. For example, they're funding, now they fund a lot of different types of agricultural work. It's not all bioengineering, but they're funding work to see if key genes for nitrogen fixation can be engineered into grains. And imagine a day without the need for nitrogen fertilizer in grains. That would be distributed freely and no differently than what's happening in American chestnut. So, I think it's really important. These two examples really highlight the importance of foundations in addressing long-term challenges.
Yeah, I mean, the American Chestnut Foundation is a citizen science member-based organization. So we get a lot of our funding from private individuals. You know, you can join the American Chestnut Foundation, you go on our website for $40, you get all of our, you know, materials and magazines on what we're doing. You know, there we have larger donations. We give you seeds from our Backcross program. But yeah, it is private individuals and foundations primarily that fund this work. And it takes a lot of, you know, there's a lot of fundraising and philanthropy and administration that's required to keep this going. So yeah, it's really dependent on the, you know, we also get a lot of help from volunteers that maintain our orchards. We have over 500 different orchards up and down the range. So these people have some of our volunteers have been working with us for multiple decades now. Mm. And so we get a lot of help from people that are just interested and captivated by this story and want to make a meaningful contribution.
Yeah, how exciting. Yeah, so listeners, if you're interested in supporting the work of the American Chestnut Foundation, I'll go ahead and make the pitch we'll put the website on the podcast, Talking Biotech Podcast homepage, and allow you to choose whether your support is financial and or other possibilities that the foundation may need.
So currently, Bill Powell has been, and his team at SUNY has been doing a lot of experiments to show that the introduction of this gene doesn't have unintended consequences. So one of the things they're looking at is, does it affect the mycorrhizal fungi, the fungi that colonize the root and help the plant take up nutrients from the soil? So they're making sure that the wheat gene doesn't interfere with the chestnut's ability to, to have mycorrhizal associations. They want to make sure that it doesn't affect the growth of the tree, it doesn't affect pollinator associations, chestnut leaf litter, the things that eat chestnut leaf litter, like tadpoles, or even screening, you know, putting this leaf litter of transgenic trees with tadpoles and having them feed on it and see, the growth of the tadpoles after they feed them with the transgenic tree versus the pure American. So they, you know, they're doing, going through all of these experiments to demonstrate that there's no harmful ecological consequences for introducing the wheat gene. And the goal is to submit this package for regulatory review with all of the results of these experiments, including the other thing is with the FDA is they got to make sure that the introduction of this gene doesn't affect the nutritional quality of the nuts. So they have demonstrated all of these things as of today, and they are planning on submitting their package for regulatory review to the USDA, the FDA, and the EPA sometime this fall and winter. And then the time frame from when they submit that package to when the decision is made is typically around 2 years.
Okay.
So that tree won't be available widely for another few years at least. Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, you guys carry on at the in the Backcross breeding program, and
Yeah, we're carrying on with the back crossbreeding program, finishing our selections using genomics. We're continuing to find and preserve the native American chestnut diversity. So that those are the main things we're doing to prepare for, you know, outcrossing this transgenic tree to many different American wild American chestnuts. I'm really appreciate the time to talk to you today, and I really appreciate all the work that's been done in the past from all of the volunteers and the collaborators and our funders that have made this work possible.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's been my pleasure to talk to you. So thanks for taking the time, Jared. So once again, Jared Westbrook, from the Director of Science from the American Chestnut Foundation, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Talking Biotech. Write a review on iTunes and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more about exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Vincelli, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.
And Dr. Westbrook forgot to mention that he used to be a student of mine in molecular and cellular biology class. Dork. Yeah, he was in our class at University of Florida, and glad to see our graduates going out and doing well. Nice job, Jared. And I'm on a plane, that's why it sounds so loud.